Second case this morning, Trinity Homes v. Ohio Casualty. Mr. Raber?
May it please the Court, my name is Mike Raber, representing the plaintiffs, appellants Trinity Homes and Beazer Homes in this matter. Your Honors, the District Court granted summary judgment to the insurance carriers in this case on two grounds. First, the Court held that damage to non-defective components of homes caused by water intrusion that was unexpected and unintended, caused by negligence of subcontractors, did not fall within the plain meaning of the terms property damage caused by an occurrence, as expressly defined in the insurance policies at issue. And second, the Court held that as a matter of law, Beazer waived any rights under the Cincinnati umbrella policy when it compromised a coverage dispute with the primary carrier. Your Honors, because as we've submitted in our briefing and motion, we believe the property damage and occurrence issues will be resolved once and for all by the Indiana Supreme Court in the forthcoming decision in the Sheehan case. Unless there are questions by the panel on that issue, I'd first turn to the question of whether the Cincinnati policy...
Do you intend to get back to that?
I do, in whatever time I have remaining, although happy to address any questions.
Well, just you can answer this question, then you can go on. How long ago was that argued?
It was argued on January 14th, Your Honor. And the Indiana Supreme Court granted transfer that same day, and it's fully briefed. There's been no request for additional briefing, so it's simply a waiting decision.
Just a waiting decision.
All right, sir. Your Honor, turning to the second issue, the district court's ruling that Beazer waived all of its rights under the Cincinnati policies by compromising a coverage dispute with a primary carrier is inconsistent with the plain language of the Cincinnati policies. The court's holding, if upheld, will force policyholders to litigate to final judgment coverage disputes with primary carriers, or else risking waiving all rights to excess insurance. As courts have recognized, a draconian result like that should only be imposed if it is dictated by the clear, unambiguous terms of the excess policy. Cincinnati policies simply do not contain such language. There are multiple disputed factual issues that would ultimately have to be resolved by the district court regarding the level at which the Cincinnati policies attach if this case is remanded. But the district court decided this case on one single narrow legal issue. The district court held that as a matter of law, under the Cincinnati policy language, when the policyholder settles an insurance claim with its primary insurer for any amount less than the full primary limits, even a penny, that the policyholder thereby waives any rights to the Cincinnati excess coverage. Our opening brief contains a hypothetical to illustrate this issue, this narrow legal issue. Assume a $5 million primary policy and a $10 million excess policy. The policyholder is found liable for a $15 million judgment, and I pay that judgment, then turn to my insurance carriers for coverage. If my primary carrier raises coverage defenses, late notice issue, an exclusion, or perhaps the primary carrier is teetering on the brink of insolvency and I have extra incentive to resolve that coverage dispute, the district court's holding is that if I accept a settlement of that coverage dispute for any amount less than the full primary limits, I thereby waive all rights to the $10 million in excess coverage. Indiana has a strong public policy that favors out-of-court resolution of lawsuits. If Cincinnati wanted to impose this harsh condition that is at odds with the public policy of Indiana and other states, it needed to do so in clear, unambiguous terms that put the policyholder on notice that if you settle an underlying claim, you waive all your rights to our excess policy. In looking at the plain language of the Cincinnati policy, Your Honors, we start with the insuring agreement. That is where coverage is granted in the policies. The insuring agreement in the Cincinnati policies is straightforward. It obligates Cincinnati to, quote, pay on behalf of the insured the ultimate net loss which the insured is legally obligated to pay as damages in excess of the underlying insurance. So according to this language, there are simply two questions to determine if the Cincinnati policy is triggered. What is the ultimate net loss, and what is the amount of the underlying insurance? These are simply numbers that have to be determined. If the ultimate net loss exceeds the amount of underlying insurance, then the Cincinnati policies are triggered to indemnify the policyholder. Beezer presented record evidence in the case that its losses were $43 million. That amount was not disputed by Cincinnati for purposes of summary judgment and therefore must be accepted for purposes of their summary judgment motion. So what is the amount of the underlying insurance? Cincinnati itself has stated in its briefing that the maximum amount of primary underlying insurance is $31 million. So therefore, even accepting, we take issue with that $31 million figure and state that it is overstated substantially. But even accepting their figures, the ultimate net loss of $43 million exceeds the amount of underlying insurance of $31 million, and the Cincinnati policies are triggered. The insuring agreement doesn't say anything about exhaustion of underlying policies. So the question is, can Cincinnati then point to any other language in its policy that takes away that grant of insurance or detracts from it, and does so in clear, unambiguous terms? And the answer is no. The district court, as urged by Cincinnati, based its holding on a provision that's not found in the insuring agreement, not found in the conditions of the policy, not found in the exclusions, but instead is found in a section called the limits of insurance. That limits of insurance section is referred to in the insuring agreement expressly. The insuring agreement says that the amount we will pay is limited as described in the limits of insurance section. So the question is whether that section, that limits of insurance section, somehow limits Cincinnati's indemnity obligation, as the district court held. If we look at the language of that section, the provision the district court relied on is item 4 of that section. It's quoted in our opening brief at pages 40 and 41. And it's the provision, the A and B provisions that you've read, that refer to reduction by payment of claims or the underlying insurance being exhausted by payment of claims. These are simply stock terms that are found in umbrella liability policies that do two things. First of all, they make clear that the underlying limits are not reinstated to their full amount after each payment of claims. And second, they make clear, just confirm, that once all of the underlying limits are exhausted, then the Cincinnati policy drops down and at that point becomes underlying insurance, which is relevant to its duty to defend. But nothing in that limits of liability section alters that basic grant of coverage in the insuring agreement that is based on the ultimate net loss and the underlying limits. In interpreting this section, Your Honors, I think it's very important to focus on that term claims. I think some courts misunderstand that term to refer to insurance claims, but in fact what it refers to are legal claims against the policyholder. These are indemnity policies that insure the policyholder against third-party claims. That meaning is made clear in the next page of the Cincinnati policy, the adjacent page, in a section entitled Duties in the Event of Occurrence, Claim, or Suit, in which that section requires the policyholder to notify Cincinnati if a claim is made or a suit is brought against any insured that is likely to involve this policy. That usage throughout the policy makes clear that when in the limits of insurance section, when it refers to payment of claims, the policy is referring to payment of claims to the third-party claimants, the plaintiffs, the underlying plaintiffs in this case, not to the payment of insurance claims by the primary carrier. So, Your Honor, nothing in this section says that Cincinnati has no coverage obligation until all of the underlying insurers have paid every penny of their primary limits. There's simply nothing in this policy that states that. That is something that would have been very easy for Cincinnati to do. And to confirm that point, all you need to do is look at the decisions in Comerica and Qualcomm from the California Court of Appeals and the Eastern District of Michigan that are relied upon by the district court. But those decisions, the policies at issue in those decisions made crystal clear the condition that Cincinnati now seeks to impose on Beazer in the absence of such language. The policy at issue in Qualcomm stated as follows, quote, underwriters shall be liable only after the insurers under each of the underlying policies have paid or have been held liable to pay the full amount of the underlying limit of liability. That is crystal clear language that unambiguously imposes the condition Cincinnati now seeks to impose through inference or implication. Likewise, the language at issue in the Comerica case from the Eastern District of Michigan referred to exhaustion of underlying insurance, quote, solely as a result of the actual payment of loss thereunder by the applicable insurers. There is nothing like that in the Cincinnati policy. This then turn to the Zide case. Your Honor, first, I think it's telling that those two decisions, Comerica and Qualcomm, were the centerpiece of the district court opinion. We pointed out those distinctions, those important language distinctions in our opening brief, and Cincinnati did not even address them in its responsive brief. The reason is they simply cannot square those decisions with the decision in this case or with their own policy.
There isn't any Indiana authority on this point.
Your Honor, there's not any controlling authority. I would point, Your Honor, to the Dana Corporation case, Your Honor. And while not directly on point, addressing a slightly different issue of exhaustion, I think the language the Dana Court used, the Indiana Supreme Court, is instructive. It's a 2001 decision. And in addressing an issue of what were the applicable limits of the underlying policy, in footnote 10, the court, in addressing whether the excess policy was triggered, stated, Allstate, that's the excess insurer, Allstate's coverage attaches as soon as liabilities are incurred in the amount of the underlying Hartford limits, that's the underlying carrier, for the applicable coverages. Whether Dana's settlement with Hartford actually exhausted the underlying limits is also irrelevant. If it did not, then Dana is self-insured up to the applicable limits, which is exactly what we're contending here, that to the extent we decide to compromise the dispute with our primary carrier, we cover the amount between the settlement and the primary limits. The Cincinnati policies do not require Cincinnati to drop down and cover the amounts above whatever we choose to settle our coverage dispute with. They only apply, and the coverage is triggered at the attachment point, which is the limits of the primary policies.
Is there any excess issue in this Sheehan case that's presently before the...
No, Your Honor. That case will not resolve these trigger issues. It will only address the property damage and occurrence issues. Your Honor, just on this question, one last point. The Zide case, which is the seminal case on this issue from 1928, the Second Circuit, it's cited in virtually every case on exhaustion. Insurers know about it. That case, Your Honors, told the put insurers on notice. It said that if insurers want to impose this condition precedent, they're free to do so. The Zide Court said that. And the insurers in the Comerica and Qualcomm case took the Zide Court up on that invitation. They added language to their policies that imposed this condition. The Zide Court, in the absence of such language, found correctly that the condition simply doesn't exist. At a minimum, Your Honor, we would submit that the silence on this issue represents ambiguity that under clear Indiana law must be construed strictly against the insurers and in favor of coverage. Your Honors, I would then plan to turn briefly to the property damage occurrence questions, unless there are other questions on that issue.
You represent in your papers that the overwhelming number of jurisdictions that have considered this issue have come down, absent some express provision in the contract, have come down with the construction that you favor.
Are you, which issue are you referring to, Your Honor? The exhaustion,
issue.
Yes. I mean, every circuit court that has addressed it has come down in our favor. We're aware of at least three, the second, third, and eighth. And there are multiple district courts. Yes, this is the majority view. When some people may talk about the Comerica and Qualcomm cases being an opposing view, I don't view those as opposing
because
views.
Because the policy is expressly provided.
Simply distinguishable cases, Your Honor. Yes.
I agree with you on this exhaustion point. Does the case have to be remanded?
Yes, Your Honor. Need to be. Because there is a significant factual dispute as to what the amount of applicable and available primary insurance is. There's also simply a factual dispute as to Beezer's ultimate net loss. What amount of that number is actually covered loss? There are multiple factual disputes. For purposes of summary judgment, that number, we've submitted evidence to support it. It must be accepted. But on remand, the district court will have to determine, as a factual matter, what is the ultimate net loss and what are the available primary limits. As one illustration of that point, that in Cincinnati's chart on page 10 and 11 of its brief, where they include what they purport to be the other insurance, that includes two policies issued by Monroe Guarantee for $2 million in limits. They're included in the 31. One of those policies terminated before a single house in this case, in the claims at issue in this case, was even constructed. It can't possibly provide coverage for a penny of the claims at issue. Yet Cincinnati includes that policy in its chart and suggests that we have to collect the full $1 million under that policy, even though no one has ever suggested that it could possibly apply to these claims. Likewise, the other Monroe Guarantee policy, only a single home closed within that policy period was completed, and that home suffered $18,000 in damage. Yet under the district court's ruling, as urged by Cincinnati, we would have had to collect a full $1 million of that, the full $1 million limits of that policy, even though at most $18,000 could have been recovered. I think that illustrates some of the factual issues and some of the flaws in Cincinnati's position. You know, I see my light is on. With respect to the property damage and occurrence, I would just make two quick points, and then I'll respond to Ohio Casualty's arguments in rebuttal. First of all, Cincinnati has demonstrated no prejudice. The insurance carriers have demonstrated no prejudice or any other reason why this court should not wait on the Indiana Supreme Court to resolve this issue. While we're certainly sensitive to this court's need to maintain its docket, in the absence of any prejudice whatsoever to the insurance companies, we think there are significant reasons, principles of comity and judicial economy, that dictate simply waiting on the Indiana Supreme Court to resolve this issue in Sheehan. Sheehan is directly on point. The insurance carriers submitted it as additional authority to the district court when the Court of Appeals decision came out in their favor. Now that the Indiana Supreme Court has vacated that decision and granted transfer, they've begun to do a 180 and say, well, maybe it's distinguishable. But simply, the distinction they offer is a point that is not found in either the Court of Appeals opinion in that case or in the district court opinion in this case. And I would submit simply can't be a basis for distinguishing those decisions. Your Honor, to the extent the court does decide to delve into this issue, I would just urge you to follow the plain language of the policy. The insurance carriers to prevail need to point to plain language in their policy that puts the policyholder on notice that any damage to any component of a home that you build is not covered because you intended to build the home, so it's not an occurrence, and because it's your home, it can't be property damage.
Counsel, we're required to follow Indiana law, are we not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Indiana law makes the construction of the policy terms a matter of law, do they not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And our job then really is to try to determine how Indiana courts would read, applying Indiana law, how those policies should be read.
Yes, Your Honor.
We don't independently search the plain meaning of the policy without guidance from Indiana law, do we?
Well, Your Honor, Indiana law dictates that, and first of all, the Indiana Supreme Court has addressed this issue. It has interpreted these precise terms.
But that's what we should be doing, it seems to me.
That's what you should do, although every policies are different. So to the extent there's some distinction in a policy, the Indiana Supreme Court would tell you to apply the plain terms of that policy.
But if there is an Indiana law construing terms in a policy, we are to follow their construction and not our own regarding plain meaning. Isn't that not true?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the Indiana Supreme Court has construed these precise terms in the DeZutti case. That is the guidance that dictates the result in this case. They found in a policy that defined property damage and occurrence identically as these policies that the claims of damage caused by subcontractors building one component of a home that resulted in damage to another component fell within the insuring agreement of a policy that defined these terms identically.
And, of course, your opponent says that Zutti has been distinguished by Thompson.
But, Your Honor, that's Court of Appeals obvious.
That's our obligation, is to try to figure out what Indiana courts applying Indiana law would do.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would urge you to read the Thompson case and see it's simply a flawed attempt to apply DeZutti. It just glosses over the distinction between the insuring agreement and the exclusions. DeZutti found no coverage on the basis of exclusions that were fundamentally different than the exclusions at issue in this case.
Do you object then to, I believe, the trial court judge as well, the statement of Indiana law that the first inquiry is to determine whether there's insurance, whether there's coverage. And if there's a determination there's no coverage, you don't read the exclusions to confer coverage.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Indiana law dictates a two-step process. Number one, do the claims fall within the insuring agreement where the terms property damage and occurrence are found? It is only then, only if the answer to that question is yes, do you move to the exclusions, which take away coverage. The DeZutti court decided based on the exclusions. It expressed to get to that second step, it had to find that the claims at issue, the same type of claims here, were within that insuring agreement. It then moved to the exclusions and said the your work exclusion excludes coverage. That your work exclusion, unlike ours, did not contain the significant exception for subcontractor work performed by subcontractors.
Right.
And that's where the R.M. Thompson Court lost its way, is it failed to recognize that important of this two-step process. It conflated those two steps and just said, well, DeZutti found no coverage, so therefore we're finding no coverage. But they didn't realize that the policy at issue in R.M. Thompson, they didn't focus on the fact that it contained that subcontractor exception like ours, and therefore the result should have been different.
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Raber.
Thank you.
Mr. Harkins?
May it please the Court, Your Honor. My name is Scott Harkness. Good morning. Defendants' appellees are simply asking this Court to uphold Indiana law, affirm the District Court's decision, and determine or set forth the law that this Court has previously done, as well as the appellate courts and Supreme Court of Indiana. I'm going to be responding to Beezer's arguments about the occurrence and property damage, the lack of both, as well as some economic loss doctrine considerations and arguments concerning no need to refer this to the Indiana Supreme Court or wait for that decision based upon the prevailing law of Indiana. Ms. Rands will talk about the exhaustion issues as well as any other questions this Court might have. We believe the issue that I'm dealing with here today can simply be stated as whether the risk being claimed by Beezer is a business risk not covered by insurance or a warranty claim, as some might describe it, or is it a risk of property damage caused by an occurrence which may have insurable liability to which coverage might apply. The District Court's ruling in this matter was correct. The District Court simply said the policies do not provide coverage for this type of a loss. Beezer overlooks the years of precedent in Indiana courts, going strictly to one case, the DeZutti case, and taking a very narrow reading of it and overlooking what the other courts did. I'll explain in a few minutes why and how they've done that. Finally, it's important to note that Beezer, in looking at these things, has sometimes changed position as to whether they're talking about terms of property damage from a contractor's point of view or terms of damages from a subcontractor's point of view. And the subcontractor's work is a much narrower description or a much narrower project than the contractor's work. Finally, it's also important to note that in this instance, the homes have been fixed. The homeowners have had their homes repaired. All that is done. Beezer is now attempting to, or has attempted to, gone after the subcontractors, made suits, third-party claims against more than 60 of them, has recovered millions of dollars on that, and is now coming to its own insurance policies to try to get even more money for its own product. Economic loss doctrine in Indiana is pretty clear. It's been talked about by a number of cases, the Gunkel case, the R. N. Thompson case. Essentially, damages recoverable in tort for defective product or service are governed by the economic loss doctrine. Physical injuries and damages to other property are recoverable in tort. Damages to the defective product itself are not recoverable in tort. CGL policies cover tort liability for physical damages to others and to other property. Because the economic loss doctrine only permits recovery for damages to other property, it is necessary to look at what the product or project of the contractor is. In this case, Beezer or Trinity had the product of the entire house. So, looking at it from the standpoint of the consumer, which is what Indiana law tells us to do, we must say, what did the consumer purchase from Beezer or Trinity? They bought the entire house. That is the product. A contractor in Indiana has two types of risks inherent in everything they do. First type is the type of risk that almost any business has. It's a business risk. It's the risk that their product doesn't live up to its expectations. It's the risk that maybe their work may not have been exactly what it was supposed to do. It's a business risk. It's trying to make good on what they sold. The second type of risk that they suffer is risk that their product or their work causes damages to some other party. And that's what an insurance policy is designed to do. It's designed to cover an accident that damages somebody else. An example, Your Honor. Contractor builds a house with a tall chimney. House is done. Shortly thereafter, the chimney falls, puts a hole in this roof of this house, and damages the neighbor's house. CGL policy of the contractor would cover the damages to the neighboring house. It would not cover the damages to this particular house and chimney built by the contractor. It would be a different analysis if we dealt with subcontractors who might have done the chimney work. It might have something that deals with the house, but we are talking about the contractor who deals with the entire product of the house. The damages claimed by Beezer in this case are not property damage. The risk to be intended to be insured by a CGL policy is the possibility that goods, products, or work of the insured, once relinquished or completed, will cause bodily injury or damage to others or other property than the product completed or the project itself, as described in the Worcester case. In analyzing property damage in Indiana, the courts across the board have simply said, we don't cover the product of itself. We must look to the damage that it causes to other things. Thus, the damage to the house, Beezer's product, is not covered under the policy. Courts are clear that damage due to faulty workmanship or defective materials does not involve property damage as that term is defined and used in the insurance policies. The Worcester case, for example, contractor built a building, had an exterior insulation finish system on it. That system failed, caused damages to the inside of the building, but just to the building itself, other systems within it. The court clearly said, we do not cover the project or product itself, only if it had damaged something else inside, a tenant's product or something that was in there. The DeZutti case that the plaintiffs talk about, a contractor built a home, footer failed, there's exterior damage to the home, caused damage only to the home itself. It didn't cause damage to anything else. Looking at the policies in that case, the Supreme Court simply jumped over to the point where even if there was property damage, even if there was an occurrence, we still find this exception. We really don't need to talk about those. And that's what that court did. It just skipped the first step simply because even if they'd done it, it would have been a moot point simply because the exceptions were there. And so the court did not deal with it. There was no need to. In this case, as well as other cases in Indiana, occurrence means an accident, including continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general harmful conditions. It's a definition under the policy. Accident is not defined in the policy, but given its plain meaning within Indiana, as well as in other states, faulty workmanship is not an accident. The majority of states hold that CGL policies do not provide coverage for faulty workmanship that damages only the resulting work product. Looking at the definition of accident, which is used in the definition of occurrence, test in Indiana, clearly set forth in R.N. Thompson, as affirmed by Auto Owners and versus Harvey in dealing with a personal property or personal lines coverage issue, and looking at the Tri-Edge case, which seems to be absent from a lot of Beezer's briefing, the test goes to the common meaning of accident, an unexpected happening without intention or design. However, the natural and ordinary consequences of an act are not an accident. And that's important because all of Indiana courts dealing with CGL policies have used that analysis. And that's what the district court used, and that's what we're asking this court to do as well. The natural and ordinary consequences of an act are not an accident. Just as in R.N. Thompson case where the degrading of the plywood roofing in a condominium project was the natural and ordinary consequences of R.N. Thompson's work or the work of their subcontractors, no coverage. Here, the water intrusion in these homes built by Beezer or their subcontractors is not an accident. It's the natural and ordinary consequences of their actions. As further described by the Indiana Supreme Court in DeZutti, a CGL policy does not cover an accident of faulty workmanship, but rather faulty workmanship which causes an accident. That is what is absent from Beezer's case here today. There is no faulty workmanship that causes an accident. It is only faulty workmanship which has affected their own project, which the courts have clearly said do not provide coverage under a CGL policy. It's also supported by the T.R. Bulger case, the Tri-Edge case, the case of Selective Insurance versus Cagnoni, and the Jim Barna Log Systems Homes case. The cases are clear. The cases are without a doubt on point and without a doubt an interpretation of what Indiana law is and what the Indiana Supreme Court would do, as the Indiana Supreme Court has affirmed in the Auto Owners versus Harvey case and in the Tri-Edge case. It's really something that we don't need to look outside of Indiana. We don't need to guess what the Indiana Supreme Court would do. We can see what they would do. We can see what the Courts of Appeals of Indiana would do. And in fact, to have a different definition, as this court has said in the Westfield versus Sheehan case that was here in the Seventh Circuit, you know, to do so would be a moral hazard that is great due to the fact that it would encourage an insured to do shoddy work and simply look to their insurers to pay for it. And in the case of an insurer actually paying the insured to fix the problem, as we have here, then the insured gets to double dip. They get paid by the homeowner when they build the house, do a lousy job, and then they go to their insurance company and say, pay us to fix the problem. They've double dipped. They've gotten paid twice, and there's a moral hazard that could be rampant, and that should not be supported by any reading of the policy. The plain language of the policy is clear. Furthermore, there is no need to stay this matter to wait to see what happens in Indiana or to refer it to the Indiana Supreme Court. This court, based on its rules, certainly has the authority to do that which it needs to do to determine what would Indiana law be. Certification should only be done if there is a question that is determinative of the case and on which there is no clear and controlling Indiana precedent. There is Indiana precedent, Your Honors, and I suggest to you that there is no need to look further to Indiana to have them say yet again what Indiana law is. There are many factors, but the most important one is whether this court finds itself genuinely uncertain about a question of law. I think this court has clearly shown that it is not uncertain about a question of law. The Westfield versus Sheehan case dealt on a topic that was on point as far as dealing with this. This court dealt with it and explained clearly what Indiana law is. Notes that there is Supreme Court law in Indiana. Notes that there's appellate court law in Indiana. And the U.S. Supreme Court even directs this court and others that an appellate court, an intermediate appellate court, is datum for ascertaining state law, which is not to be disregarded by the federal court.
The only thing I can say that very similar language several years ago, the panel took it upon itself to interpret it, and 6 months later, the Supreme Court came out 180 degrees from what this panel determined.
I suspect any federal court. District court or appellate court deals with an issue like that, but in this instance, I believe there's compelling Indiana decisions based from the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals in order to deal with this topic. Based on this, Your Honor, we believe that it is important to note that it's Indiana law being applied, which may be different from any other state. There's ample decision in Indiana to guide this court, and we would note that this, again, is not a sympathetic matter in which the homeowners have not been recovered, that they have, the homes have been fixed. We ask that you affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Rands?
May it please the court, my name is Christy Rands, and on behalf of Cincinnati Insurance Company, who provided Beazer with two umbrella excess policies, I'm here to discuss the district court's correct ruling as it pertains to Beazer's failure to properly exhaust its underlying insurance. Your Honors, from the very onset of this case, Cincinnati has clearly and unequivocally alleged that its umbrella excess policies are fundamentally different than any other policies in this case. The phrase underlying insurance in Cincinnati's umbrella policies is defined to include not just those policies listed in its schedule of insurance, as Beazer has contended, but also any other policies applicable to the occurrence. That makes Cincinnati's umbrella policies fundamentally different than any of the other excess policies issued in this case by any of the other insurance companies. The requirement that Beazer exhaust its underlying insurance is a prerequisite for coverage under Cincinnati's umbrella policies and an issue that the district court correctly found to be dispositive. Now, Cincinnati, as Beazer has stated...
What's the policy justification for the district court decision in this case?
Your Honor, that is to enforce the
Doesn't
clear...
Doesn't it discourage settlements?
No, it does not discourage settlements, and that is a public policy, but the more important public policy, and the public policy that plaintiffs have talked about, takes a back seat to the public policy of enforcing clear policy language such as that is included in the Cincinnati umbrella policy. And that's the distinction that the district court in another case, Irving Materials, Judge Barker made. You must enforce the clear and unequivocal language in a policy. In the language in the Cincinnati policy, if you go specifically to Section 3, Paragraph 4, entitled Limits of Insurance, it specifically says the limits of underlying insurance must be exhausted by the payment of claims. It does not provide anywhere in the policy that Beazer can do a settlement plus credit approach, where they can settle for some...
You seem to be saying the insured gets everything he can out of the primary insurer, but that's not good enough. You got to get more. Is that your position?
Because it is, Your Honor, because you must enforce the clear policy language that Cincinnati has
provided.
Well,
you're wrong on the language. You don't have any policy then.
Well, it's the policy to enforce the clear contract.
The policy to enforce the language. All right.
Cincinnati has provided the chart on pages 10 through 12 of its appellee brief, demonstrating that there is, in fact, $121 million of coverage. Instead, Beazer has voluntarily settled with its underlying insurers for only $13 million. Obviously, Beazer's underlying policies provide more than adequate coverage for its alleged $43 million in total damages, and the ultimate net loss does not exceed their underlying insurance. This chart also demonstrates that not a single set of underlying policies have been exhausted. Now, the district court below held that the language in Cincinnati's policy was clear because the term underlying insurance is defined to include all other insurance applicable to the occurrence. The district court also looked at the issue of when an underlying policy is available, with its determination hinging upon whether or not an underlying policy has been exhausted or merely reduced, as in the present case. Now, once again, the district court found this language to be clear and straightforward, given the limits of insurance clause, which provides that if the limits of underlying insurance have only been reduced by payments of claims, Cincinnati's umbrella policies continue in force as excess.
Picking up on that, I'm looking at page 12 of your brief, and you quote it a little more fully. You say, quote, the section of CIC's umbrella policies provides that if, interior quotes, the limits of underlying insurance, end interior quotes, have been reduced by the payments of claims, this policy will continue in force as excess of the reduced, interior quotes, underlying insurance, end interior quotes. Or if the limits of the, quote, underlying insurance have been exhausted by the payment of claims, this policy will continue in force as underlying insurance, end quote. But that language doesn't say payment of claims by whom. And it's the appellant's argument, as I understand it, that they're referring to claims to third parties, and that by settling this, the insured has assumed part of the responsibility of paying the underlying claim. That's the construction, I take it, they're urging. And frankly, that seems to be a fair reading of the paragraph you were referring to, but I don't think is quite as fully as what you set out in your papers.
Well, in response to your question, Your Honor, Section 4 of the policy does provide require that the limits of underlying insurance be exhausted by the payment of claims. Now, while it does not talk about who specifically needs to pay those claims, the only parties in this case that have limits of underlying insurance to be paid or to be exhausted are the underlying insurers, and they have not fulfilled their obligations in paying their full policy limits that would then, in fact, trigger Cincinnati's coverage in this case. And nowhere in the policies is there any provision that would provide Beazer to settle with its underlying insurers for less than the underlying limits provided, and then get a settlement, have a settlement plus credit approach that they're contending. And if the court would adopt a situation like that.
But your client wouldn't be out of pocket any more money in that regard, because their obligation would only take over once that underlying amount of money had been satisfied.
But, Your Honor, these policies are all stacked in accordance to when they are intended to pick up. And an excess umbrella policy, that's a policy of last resort that Cincinnati has provided. It is only when all underlying insurance has been exhausted, and it's been priced accordingly. Beazer has paid much more for its underlying policies and its plain excess policies than what it's ever paid for its umbrella policies that Cincinnati has provided. And now if the court is going to allow plaintiffs such as Beazer to settle for much less than their underlying policies, when is it going to end? Because we're also dealing with the duty to defend.
But that would be Cincinnati's obligation had Beazer gone to trial and lost that amount. Why would there be a different effect in any regard to your client?
If Beazer had gone to trial and it was determined that the Regent policies did not apply or any other underlying policies did not apply, Cincinnati would have no exposure in that case.
No, I'm talking about if Beazer had gone to trial and lost the amount of the underlying policy, then Beazer's obligation would be triggered. Isn't that right? Cincinnati's obligation.
No, it would not, because no underlying insurer was triggered. The underlying insurers have to be triggered first and exhausted before you get into the...
Well, let's assume that Beazer goes to trial, loses, and the underlying insurers then pay that judgment, and there's an excess.
If it was paid in full, Your Honor, then Cincinnati's umbrella policies, if all underlying policies were exhausted, not just the Regent policies,
I assume we're talking about horizontal and vertical exhaustion. Like, I'm just talking about, you were talking about the economics of the cheaper rate to purchase umbrella insurance, and that how that would somehow be disturbed if we were to come down, if we were to reverse the district court. Yep. But I'm saying that Cincinnati would face the same exposure if Beazer had gone to trial, lost $43 million judgment, and the underlying policies, however you want to construe them, paid $31 million. You'd still have to pay that amount.
Your Honor, I would say that the duty to if we set this policy, and I see that my time has expired.
I'm sorry,
but
I didn't mean to.
Can I go ahead and answer your question?
Please.
Okay. I think that what is important is the policy here, because if the court is to follow what Beazer is asking it to do, it could go and do a targeted tender to any of its underlying insurers, settle for a dollar, let's say, and then all of a sudden they're up into an excess umbrella policy, which issued that policy only intending to provide coverage when any and all of the underlying policies were fully exhausted. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I would like to thank the court for its time.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
What if there was a good faith finding as to the settlement by a competent judicial authority by a district court judge?
That there was exhaustion.
That the settlement was made in good faith and reasonably approximated the amount of loss.
Your Honor, I don't think that
I mean, it would obviate this fraud concern that Cincinnati
seems to
have.
Sure, and I would go back to the Qualcomm case and the Comerica case, where the court specifically looked at a situation where, similar to what Beazer has done in this case, in its settlement agreements, it put the language, the underlying insurers would be deemed to be exhausted. Both courts in that case found that putting such language in a contract or in a settlement release between an insurance company and an insurer could not bind a third-party excess insurer and, in fact, trigger its liability.
Thank you.
I'm
sorry. Your time has expired, but I'll give you another minute.
Your Honor, first, while I would love to address Ohio Casualty's arguments on the property damage occurrence issues, in the interest of time, I'll simply reiterate that this court should be guided by the opinions of the Indiana Supreme Court. We will have this pronouncement in due course. The U.S. Supreme Court, as Judge Kahn has acknowledged, has talked about the rule of law being undermined by federal courts predicting state court judgments and then having those turn out to be disagreed with by the state court. On exhaustion, Your Honor, this is the first time that I've heard Cincinnati argue that other excess policies have to be exhausted. In their brief at pages 7 and 8, they talk about Indiana law saying that other primary insurance has to be exhausted. Each of the other excess insurance policies that are listed in their chart are in the record in this case. They have identical other insurance clauses that state that they are excess over other valid and collectible insurance. Those excess clauses cancel each other out under well-established Indiana law, and it is only other primary insurance policies that must be exhausted. Cincinnati's chart on their brief includes, for example, a $25 million Lloyd's of London policy that a Georgia court found in late 2008 does not possibly apply to these claims. It doesn't apply to these entities, doesn't apply to these claims. That was a final judgment. Cincinnati was aware of it over a year ago, and yet they included that in their chart as part of their $121 million number.
Thank you, Mr. Raymond.
Time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.